say hello to a new friend on an old road. Take a two-lane trip of memories and the mysteries unknown. Come along for the ride. Jim Hinckley's America. Jim Hinckley's America.
Good morning, mi amigos. It is 55 degrees here at studios of Jim Hinckley's America, within spitting distance of legendary Route 66. We're on track for some record-breaking heat today. It's going to be somewhere around 90 degrees before the end of the day. Tad bit warm. We're going to take a little bit of a detour today from Route 66. We're going to head south to San Pedro River country and visit with Ron Stewart. Talk about one of my favorite people. Somehow he fell through the cracks of history, like a lot of these folks, like Ralph Teeter, the blind fellow that invented cruise control. Today we're going to talk about Jeff Davis Milton, a real fascinating character, and of course some ghost towns and Coronado, and well, a few other road trip inspiring adventures this morning with Ron Stewart. Hey, Ron, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Jim?
You know, every day is good. Some days are just better than others. How's things down in your neck of the woods?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep, I got you here. Yeah, it sounds like we're having just a tad bit of an issue. I can hear Ron, but I don't know if he can hear us. Ron has spent a lot of time studying Southern Arizona history. And this is an area that gets overshadowed a lot by Tombstone. Mr. Ron? You know, most everybody's heard of Tombstone and Wyatt Earp and his brothers. But really is a study in how promotion and marketing works. Wyatt Earp really was a small character in the really Western history. And Tombstone was really just another one of those dusty mining camps. But there's a lot more history there. And hopefully we can get Ron straightened out here.
Can you hear me now, Jim?
Yes, Ron.
Good.
There we go. It's always fun with this technology. It's it either works or it doesn't.
Like most things.
Yes. So how's things down in your neck of the woods?
Things are good. We're heading into some warm weather. I guess our long, cool spring is finally coming to an end. Coming into some beautiful early summer weather, high in the low 80s.
Yeah, we're going to hit 90 today up here. But they're talking 89 to 90 this afternoon. Tad bit early for that.
It's too hot too soon.
Yes. Oh, we were just talking to mention this morning. I was really excited that you, first of all, thank you for doing this. The whole idea behind this is to inspire some road trips and introduce people to chapters of America's story that get overlooked. And Fairbank, San Pedro River country, and Mr. Milton, they've definitely gotten overlooked.
Well, that's probably true. Southeast Arizona remains an area that's not well known at this point in time. I'm not necessarily unhappy about that, by the way, but
no.
I will do my part to help people understand it better. There's a lot of history to talk about here.
You know, I agree with you 100% about you're glad that people don't know, but it's kind of nice that they do know. I hate for things to get too crowded. And aside from Tombstone and, well, Bisbee, you know, that whole neck of the woods down there really gets overlooked a lot.
It does. Again, particularly for people who are interested in history, you know, we literally have 13,000 years of history here, going back to the time of the Clovis Paleo Indians, who bands of Clovis hunters wandered into the San Pedro River Valley sometime around 13,000 years ago, hunting the large megafauna, as it's called, things like mammoths and extinct species of bison and camels and horses that all lived along the San Pedro River. Groups of perhaps as many as 30 Clovis hunters came into the area to hunt these animals. It was at a place called Murray Springs. It was excavated in the 1960s that the first ever Clovis campsite was discovered. The Clovis culture was found in New Mexico back in the 1930s, but in the 1960s, Dr. Vance Haynes from the University of Arizona discovered a campsite of the Clovis along near the San Pedro River at a spring about a half mile west of the river, which was a large marshy area at that time, which attracted these large animals. And so the Clovis hunters came and using atlatl, which was a spear-throwing device, we were able to kill and then butcher some of these animals and stayed there to process the meat and live there for a while before they moved on. This was quite a revolutionary discovery back in the 1960s when it occurred, but that was the start, at least at this point, as far as we know, of human history in this area.
The San Pedro River, would I be correct that that is one of the oldest river systems in the Southwest?
I would not necessarily. It's one of the oldest. It is unusual in several ways, though. It's one of the few rivers that runs from south to north. There are actually several here that all flow into the Gila, the San Simon River, the Santa Cruz, and the San Pedro all run from headwaters either in Mexico or near the border and on north to join in the Gila. And there are just very few. The Red River up in the Midwest, there are a few others, but it's somewhat unusual in that regard. It's also unusual, again, in that the headwaters are in Mexico. But no, it's not necessarily one of the oldest rivers. It actually was an internal basin itself until some point in time. We're talking millions of years ago, but still that makes it relatively new. And the river carved a pathway eventually out of this basin to the north where it met with the Gila.
I know that that is one of the state's best riparian areas. It's an absolutely gorgeous area down there.
It is that. You know, the San Pedro River today is known as one of the last remaining cottonwood willow gallery forests in the Southwest. It's one of the few rivers that remains undammed at this point in time, has flowing water year-round, at least in some areas. And that flowing water supports a forest of cottonwoods and willows. As a north-south running river, that's an important feature for wildlife. In prehistoric times or early historic times, there were a number of flyways where migratory birds could follow rivers running from north to south as they traverse from the tropics on to the north or and then back south later on. San Pedro River is one of the few remaining flyways available to these animals. So we see a tremendous diversity of birds coming north and south during the year, all able to do so because of that surviving cottonwood willow riparian forest that's along that last undammed surviving river. There have been others in the Southwest in the past. For instance, the Santa Cruz River south of Tucson used to serve that same role. It was largely been depleted by mining and agriculture and use for residential water. Just recently, they've started using effluent to reanimate parts of that river, and it's coming back to life and serving that same purpose again. But the San Pedro River has never been dammed and remains an important asset in the natural world.
The other day when we were talking, we mentioned the Coronado Expedition. Was that in that San Pedro area? Did Coronado cross through that area?
There's been a bunch of interesting developments in the scholarship surrounding the Coronado Expedition here within the last couple of years. Coronado Expedition's route has always been subject to speculation by scholars. In the past, most researchers have relied on interpretation of the journals left behind by the Coronado Expedition. They would try to piece together the route of the expedition by reading, to make something up, reading in the journal. It says, yes, and here we encountered a large mountain shaped like a loaf of sugar or something, just to make something up. And so then they would go looking, well, let's see, what mountains are there that are shaped like a loaf of sugar, and try to do that. Just recently here, happens to be a friend of mine, an archaeologist named Dr. Denny Seymour. Denny has been going around on the ground around the Southwest, actually looking for evidence of the Coronado Expedition. And in doing so, she has discovered a number of sites where she's found artifacts that are definitive of the Coronado Expedition. This has totally revolutionized the understanding of the route that Coronado came through this area. Previously, it was assumed that Coronado came north along the coast of Mexico, then along the Rio Sonora Valley, crossing through a large plains area near Cananea in northern Sonora, and then to the headwaters of the San Pedro and down the San Pedro for a ways. Dr. Seymour has discovered that instead, most likely the expedition came further from the west, up meeting the Santa Cruz River, and then heading northeast from the Santa Cruz to the San Pedro, and then on up towards Zuni, or Cibola, as they knew it. So the Coronado Expedition was once thought to have used the San Pedro as a major route, and that is still true, but to a lesser degree. It's now known that instead of coming up the San Pedro, they were on first on the Santa Cruz, then cut overland to the San Pedro, camped along it, followed it for a ways, and then headed on to the northeast. So the San Pedro was attractive to Coronado for the same reason it was attractive to the birds today. It was a source of water. It was a place where there was forage for the thousands of herd of cattle and horses that he had with him. And provided sustenance for them as they migrated north in the same way that it still supports the birds today.
You know, and fast forwarding in the timeline a little bit, I know Fairbank is something you're really passionate about. How big was Fairbank at its peak? I don't imagine it was a real big settlement, but
no, Fairbank at its most had maybe 300 people. Okay. That does not sound like much, and I guess it isn't much, but in terms of its time and place, that was actually a fairly significant city in territorial Arizona. But it hit around 300 people a couple of times. Probably the population went up and down, but in the 1890s, and then again, maybe in the 1920s, it hit that level. Never much more than that.
You know, it's interesting. It doesn't matter if we're talking politics, cars, or ghost towns. It's amazing how marketing publicity can make things appear larger than they are. And when we started this morning, I was talking about Tombstone and Wyatt Earp, how they've been magnified into something, made them appear much larger than they really were. And then places like Fairbank and Mr. Milton somehow got lost in the shadow of that. And I have found Mr. Milton, Jeff Davis Milton, is I have just had a fascination with this fellow for years. I discovered him some years ago in a project I was doing with Bob Bozbell. And gosh, what a career. What is his law career was like from 1878 to like 1931, 32?
Yes.
Gosh.
Yeah, Jeff is somehow or other Jefferson Davis Milton has somehow become a figure that has faded from common memory. You know, you and I were talking about this a little bit the other day. It's you know, he has never had a movie made about him, as far as I know, has never appeared as a character anywhere in the media or television or anything, unlike some of the others, although arguably his contribution and what he did is certainly as significant as just about anybody.
I would say more significant and definitely a diverse career, not just in the time span on how things changed, but from Texas Ranger to his work on the railroad, the border, a very diverse career.
Yeah. He, you know, it started, I don't know if you want to go through the whole story of Jeff Milton, it's quite a long story, but quite an interesting character. You know, it's his family claimed that he was descended from the poet Milton. And it is the fact that his family was among the first to arrive in Virginia in the early 1600s, a very prominent family in the South. At the time of the Civil War, his father was the governor of the Confederate state of Florida. About the time of the end of the Civil War, his father was killed. I was reading up on this last night to refresh my memory, and I'd always read that his father killed himself at the prospect of the South losing the war. But apparently that's now in doubt. There's been more recent scholarship which indicates that maybe his father died in a hunting accident when he was like cleaning his hunting rifle or something. But at any rate, that ended the prominence of Milton's family in Florida, and he was forced to move to Texas as a young man to live with his sister and her husband, worked for a rancher for a while. And then when he was 20 years old, using letters of reference from prominent family friends, he was able to get an appointment with the Texas Rangers. So actually, he lied about his age. He was too young to do it, but he was able to get on 1 year early. He was 20 at the time. While in Texas, he worked as a Texas Ranger for 4 years, assigned in the area of Presidio, Texas, which is right on the border with Mexico. If you've ever been to Big Bend National Park, Presidio is right by that. And at that time, it was undoubtedly probably the most lawless, this would have been the 1880s, the most lawless area in the United States. And this is where he learned to be a lawman as a Texas Ranger. Later on, he went to do things. He was chief of police in El Paso, Texas. He worked as a stock inspector. You know, that sounds like, you know, somebody that checks cows or something, and they did. But what a stock inspector did was look at examine the brands of cattle, trying to find stolen cows. And then when they determined that cattle were stolen, it was their job to take action on that, to try to catch who had stolen them or turn them to their owners and so forth. Worked as a deputy sheriff in Cochise County, working for Texas John Slaughter, the infamous Texas John Slaughter, who Texas John Slaughter, by the way, is one who there were TV shows about. I watched shows about him. The Mickey Mouse Club, when I was growing up, had a little short about Texas John Slaughter that had a theme song that the remarkable lyrics of Texas John Slaughter, they did what they oughter, and if they didn't, they died.
Oh, you
so,
gotta love it.
Yeah, so that was, you know, that was back when things like that were idolized a little bit more. But at any rate, he was a deputy with John Slaughter. He worked as a Wells Fargo Express agent, where he had probably his, we'll save that story, probably had his most famous incident, which was when he foiled a train robbery. And, you know, the things he became known for among his contemporaries, though, came a little bit later in life. He was a Chinese inspector at a time when the United States was very concerned about the immigration of people from China. He had the responsibility for patrolling the border between basically Ajo and Yuma. He became a Border Patrol agent. He is credited by the Border Patrol the modern U.S. Border Patrol as being the first Border Patrol agent. And if you go to the Border Patrol Museum in El Paso, Texas, which I have, they have like a little shrine to Jeff Davis, or Jeff Milton, excuse me. And his badge that he was issued was badge, you know, on law enforcement badges. I don't know if you've ever been involved in law enforcement. They always have, every badge has a serial number on it. This is to, this is an accountable item. A person to whom that's issued is expected to take care of that badge. And if it's lost, they can tell whose badge, who lost it by that serial number. Well, Jeff Milton's Border Patrol badge has the number one on it. He was the very first Border Patrol agent. And I've talked with Border Patrol agents, modern Border Patrol agents, and they know who Jeff Milton was. They're very well aware of him and look up to him in a way as a role model upon which all subsequent Border Patrol agents were founded. Another incident that I want to share that I was reading up on last night. This is kind of a forgotten chapter of American history. Right after World War I, the United States was very afraid of all of the European immigrants coming in, fleeing war-torn Europe. Among these were a large number of people with radical politics, anarchists, Bolsheviks from Russia, and others. This was during Woodrow Wilson's administration. Wilson was a very conservative president, and his Justice Department, headed by a guy named Palmer, rounded up large numbers of these radicals, as they viewed them. And there were indeed, there were bombings, there were a number of things going on. This was not just a scare, there was a real threat. But at any rate, they rounded up. Eventually, what happened, 260 of these were deported. Of these people were deported. They were loaded on a ship in New York. Well, Jeff Milton in Arizona was working for the Customs Service at that time, and he received a telegram that he was supposed to report to New York. And he arrives there, and what he ended up doing is he was assigned as one of the guards on this ship that took these 260 political prisoners, if you will, or who were being deported to Russia, and escorted them from New York to Finland to Russia, where they were forced to stay in Russia, newly communist Bolshevik Russia. This was their punishment for being radicals in the U.S. So there's another thing that Jeff Milton was involved in that transcended his role in the frontier that, Let's see Wyatt Earp match that one.
Exactly. And, the interesting thing about that, I was vaguely aware that he had escorted these people back to Russia. But what made that even more fascinating was this was long after his injury that basically left him with one arm.
Yeah, that was in the course, in the train robbery in Fairbank. Mm-hmm. My ghost town, Fairbank. Yeah, so shall we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, please.
Well, it's a long story. I guess we have time. And it starts actually a year earlier. In 1899, a train was pulling into the station in Cochise, Arizona. Cochise, still there. There's a really interesting old railroad hotel there that you can still have meals and stay in. But at any rate, Cochise was a railroad stop on the Southern Pacific line. So a train was pulling into Cochise, and when it arrived, there were gunmen waiting there for them. A gunman had gotten onto the train while it was slowing down, and he forced the engineer to stop. They detached the Wells Fargo Express car that was attached to that train. Well, and this, it's always hard to tell these stories without all the background. Wells Fargo Express. Wells Fargo was a banking company that whose main business was to move money from place to place. Back at that time, 1899, if you wanted to, say, pay a payroll in a mine, or let's say Fort Huachuca, you didn't write checks. You didn't do a wire transfer to their account, you actually handed out bills and coins. And to do this required there be a lot of specie available. Wells Fargo and other companies were in the business of moving that money from point A to point B so that people could get paid, so debts could be paid and so forth. Well, this started as stagecoaches. You see like in a Western, a stagecoach, and on top of it, there's a guy with the reins driving the stagecoach, and sitting next to him is typically, in the movies anyway, someone with a shotgun, which interestingly enough is where, when you want to sit next to the driver, you say, I got shotgun. That's where that comes from. It's from the armed guard with a shotgun that used to ride on stagecoaches. How that ended up in modern language is kind of an interesting question. But at any rate, so that man with the shotgun, was probably always a man, was actually not an employee of the stagecoach. He was an employee of Wells Fargo or one of these other companies. And sitting under his feet would have been a locked box of cash. He was there to transport valuable items and protect it. That when railroads came along, that job evolved. Railroads started to have attached to them cars that belonged to Wells Fargo or one of these other companies. And in those cars would be a large locked box for cash. They also got into the business of moving packages. So there would be all sorts of packages in these railroad cars. And then finally, there'd be an armed guard. The armed guard, and this is the descendant of the man riding shotgun on the stagecoach, was known as a Wells Fargo Express agent. And they were there to protect the locked box. But also, it's like the cattle inspectors. They weren't there to protect the locked box. They were there that if they got robbed, it was their job to go hunt down the person that robbed it. And the general understanding was to hunt them down and kill them. So this was the job that Jeff Milton had at that time. He was working for Wells Fargo Express. But now let's go back to 1899, the robbery at Cochise. The train comes in. There's a Wells Fargo Express car with a lockbox with, and the robbers knew this, $10,000 in gold in this lockbox. When the train arrived at the station, they decoupled the Wells Fargo Express car. And I don't know if it was the last car on the train, but, and the way the geography was, it actually it rolled away from town. They knew that the armed guard, that the agent would not have the combination or the keys to the safe is the way they did it. They were prepared. They had dynamite. They blew up the safe and they got away with the gold. Now, an aside, have you ever seen the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The scene where they rob a train and blow up the safe and it shatters and all, they lose all the money because it goes everywhere. That actually is roughly based on that robbery. But so at any rate, this happened in 1899. Nobody knew who did the robbery. They got away clean with it. Then about a year later, in February of 1900, another train pulls into the station in my ghost town, Fairbank, Arizona. It pulls up to the platform. The station agent for Wells Fargo comes out. He opens the door of the express car in which Jeff Milton is working as the guard. They start to unload some packages that need to be unloaded at Fairbank there. And all of a sudden, they become aware that there are gunmen on the platform at the station. These gunmen tell them to throw down their guns and give up. Well, of course, Milton isn't going to do that. Milton grabs his scatter gun. They slam the door shut of the car. Their gunfire is exchanged. Milton fires his shotgun and hits a fellow by the name of Three Finger Jack Dunlop. That's one of my favorite Old West names. Old Three Finger Jack.
Three fingers. You wonder how he came up with that name.
Well, he I can tell you that. He had lost two fingers in a previous illegal activity, and that was therefore, that was a descriptive, not just a nickname, but a descriptor, Three Finger Jack. So anyway, he hit Three Finger Jack, and there were four other outlaws along with Three Finger Jack. They fire, they hit Milton's upper arm, as you alluded to. It's bleeding badly. Milton takes the keys to the safe. He had the keys. I don't know why the robbery at Cochise did not. There's a question to research. There, he had the keys. He threw the keys away, slammed the door shut on the express car, ripped the sleeve on his shirt, used it to tie a tourniquet around his arm to stop the bleeding, and passed out. Well, the robbers were afraid to come into the car. They didn't know. One of them had already been hit really badly. They didn't want to get killed. They grabbed the station agent, made him go in the car. He looked at Milton, who was actually still alive, but told the outlaws he was dead and not to waste a bullet on him. The outlaws look around. They can't find the keys. By this point in time, the passengers and others in the town started getting organized. The outlaws realized they needed to flee, and they did. They grabbed Three Finger Jack off the ground, got on their horses, and rode off to the east towards the Dragoons, where they were hiding out. Along the way, they left Three Finger Jack behind. He told them to. The posse followed them out of Fairbank after it was organized, and they found Three Finger Jack on the ground. They took him to jail in Tombstone. Three Finger Jack was being interviewed the next day or soon thereafter, and he told a very, very interesting story. He said, yes, I was in charge of the group of robbers here at Fairbank, but I got to tell you, I'm not in charge of this operation. This train robbery and the one last year in Cochise were both organized by Bert Alvord and Billy Stiles. Now, Bert Alvord at that time was the constable of the city of Wilcox. And Billy Stiles, and I've heard two versions of this, he was either Alvord's deputy in Wilcox, or he was a deputy constable in Pierce, Arizona, which was nearby. Well, Alvord had been the main person that had responded to the robbery at Cochise the previous year. In fact, he had organized a posse out of Wilcox to go try to find the robbers. And somehow or other, in riding around with the posse, had managed to cover up all the horse tracks of the robbers who were able to get away. He had an alibi. He was in a poker game in a back room in a bar in Wilcox at that time. He had a similar alibi for the robbery in Fairbank. But now it was revealed that it was actually Constable Alvord and Billy Stiles that had organized and financed the robbery. The story goes on and on and on. Alvord and Stiles were arrested. One of them agreed to give evidence for the other one, but instead came to the jail, the county jail in Tombstone, and busted the other one out. They ended up in jail again later in Tombstone. They dug their way out of the jail. They did both end up serving time in prison. But, you know, it's funny. I was reading about this again last night to refresh my memory. At that time, train robberies in Arizona was a hanging offense, but no one was ever actually convicted and hung for doing it. It was, you know, viewed as sort of a, you know, this is my interpretation. These train robbers were sort of like viewed as Robin Hood or something. You know, and when they would come to trial, inevitably the charge of train robbery would be dismissed, and instead they would be charged under some lesser crime that involved a couple of years in prison. And usually those terms were commuted or they were let out early for one reason or another. So some or other people in Arizona did not view train robbery as a serious offense. Now back to Jeff. Before we leave Bert and Billy, you know, both Bert Alvord ended up going to Panama to work on the Panama Canal. And the story is that while he was there, he contracted a disease and died there. You know, I have, just by coincidence, was one day walking around Tombstone, and a young man was working on renovation of a building. I started talking to him, and he said, yeah, I'm I'm Bert Alvords. I don't know how we got on the topic, but at any rate, I'm Bert Alvords. It was like great, great nephew or something. And, you know, he didn't really die. You know that, right? And his family, it was known that Bert had survived and this, that, and the other. And so, you know, these stories never end. Did Bert actually die in Central America, or did he come back? And same sort of story with Billy Stiles. Billy ended up working as a lawman again in California and had a long life and career. But there was a fine line between being an outlaw and being a lawman in the Old West. And a lot of times that line was crossed. Let's get back to Jeff, though. So we left Jeff. Last time we saw Jeff, he was lying with a tourniquet around his arm in a Wells Fargo Express car in Fairbank. When news of the robbery spread, the train took him to Benson. The train he was on, unscheduled, took him to Benson, and then a special train was laid on to take him to St. Mary's Hospital, which is still a hospital in Tucson. There they operated on his arm. They had to remove part of the bone from his upper arm. They used piano wire to wire the parts of his arm back together. And he had pretty much lost all use of that arm at that time. He was sent to San Francisco to a hospital there and ended up having surgery, more successful surgery on his arm, and did regain partial use of that arm. But it was basically, he was an invalid in terms of his arm the rest of his life and could just barely use it.
You know, see, that's the part of the story. When you think about this, half of his law enforcement career was accomplished as a one-armed man. And that's just mind-boggling to have the gumption to do that. Most people would probably take that as time to retire and find a more peaceful line of work.
I was reading a quote about that last. There's a book by Jeff Milton that needs to be mentioned. It's called Jeff Milton, A Good Man with a Gun. It's written by J. Evetts Haley.
Yes.
And in this, Haley wrote his book not that long after Milton had died. He interviewed a lot of his family members and his wife and so forth. Had a lot of original material in there. But there's one story in there. Talks about later on when he was working as a Customs and Border Patrol agent, he would drive a Model T rather than ride a horse. And that may very well be because of the arm. I hadn't really thought of that. But at any rate, talked about that when he would get in his Model T, he would swing his left arm up and lodge it on the steering wheel, really driving with it. And he couldn't really use that arm for much, but he would leave it on the steering wheel to disguise the fact that he had no use of it. And then he would drive really with his right hand. So that was, you know, an adaptation that he did to that arm, with that arm.
You know, that would make sense. A Model T, you don't have a gear shift. You know, you're the only thing you would have to use your left arm for is your spark advance. And that wouldn't be a real, you know, challenging situation.
So it didn't have gears?
No, the Model T is very unusual. You have, you'd have to use your left arm for the handbrake. And the handbrake is your brake as well as low gear. You have three pedals on the floor. Three pedals on the floor where the clutch usually is high gear, neutral. And then your gas, let's see if I remember this right, where your gas pedal is would be reverse. And then you had your brake pedal. And your throttle and your spark are adjusted on the steering column. With that little thumb levers.
That may be why he had one.
Yeah, that would make and they were good, durable automobiles. Fairbank, what's left in Fairbank today?
There are a few. There's a handful of historic buildings left in Fairbank. It, you know, was founded in 1882. It lasted until 1972. The area it was in was didn't have a whole lot of people living there. The ranch, this is a long story, of course, but the ranch that ended up owning the property that Fairbanks sits on was not really interested in having a, they wanted to use it for grazing. They didn't want a ghost town there. So over the years, people would go and jack up the old buildings, load them onto the back of a truck, take them other places. There are a number of houses in Tombstone that used to be in Fairbank. There are a couple in Benson that used to be in Fairbank. Others, after they sat derelict for a while, people would come and take the windows and the doors and lumber. You know, it's we're very spoiled in modern times with, it may not feel this way, but we're actually very wealthy by comparison with the past.
Yes.
And, you know, if somebody abandoned a building and left a bunch of lumber and windows and doors and whatnot, someone was going to go get that. I mean, that wasn't just going to sit there and rot away. And that's what happened to most of the ghost towns around the West, in places where there was population. You know, to find an intact old ghost town, that pretty well is going to be in an area where there really weren't a whole lot of other people living. If there are other people nearby, that was going to be scavenged down to nothing. So all that's left in Fairbank today are the main buildings that were still in use up until 1972 or so, when the town stopped being a ghost town. By then, people weren't so much into scavenging old buildings anymore, so some of them survived. The mercantile building is the most interesting of those. It was a large railroad express. I don't know if you know what that is. Railroad express operation that ran there. Fairbank was a railroad town. There were four different railroads that operated there. And, of course, all of the merchandise coming into the area was coming in via the railroad. All of the products coming out of the mines in Tombstone were going out by the railroad. All the cattle that were being raised in the ranches. So it was a Fairbank, small though it was, 300 people, was a commercial hub. And the mercantile was a building at which people would come to order merchandise and equipment and mining equipment and whatnot from factories back east, where it would be delivered to the mercantile and then distributed from there. So that's the largest building in the town. It's one of the biggest. Chiffon Hall in Tombstone is the biggest. But the mercantile building in Fairbank is one of the largest remaining adobe structures in Cochise County. And the only reason it's still standing is because Bureau of Land Management that operates Fairbank has done such a great job preserving it. But so the mercantile is there. Also, there's a schoolhouse. There are a couple of other buildings that were built by the Works Progress Administration in the 1930s. And then there's one house that's there from the ranching days, where ranch hands lived. But those are the only buildings left. I mean, there are old foundations and materials from the town scattered all over the place. It was also a large Indian village site at one point in time. Because of its geography, it was always attractive to people.
You know, another thing I found that a lot of these ghost towns disappeared, Gold Road, Arizona, on Route 66 up in the Black Mountains. Apparently, Arizona, I don't know when this was enacted, when this took place, but there was a law, a tax situation, that even buildings that were not in use were taxed. And so when the mining operations in the early 1940s started to fade out there in Gold Road, the mining company dismantled most of the buildings, sold off the materials, or they sold the buildings for salvage.
That makes sense. Well, and, you know, similar to that was the railroad companies. There was up until the railroad stopped operation in Fairbank in 1966, there was actually a small settlement. We call it South Fairbank, south of the town. And this was the housing for all the railroad employees. You know, here's another survival. Have you ever heard of a railroad apartment?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Railroad apartment is one that basically has no hallways. You enter the front door, you're in the living room. You go into another door and you're in the kitchen. Go into another door, you're in the bedroom, you know, and so forth. There are no hallways. It goes from room to room to room, very long and narrow, called a railroad apartment. Well, where that name comes from is in the old days, it may still be going on for all I know, but in the old days, you know, railroad would build into a new town. Well, suddenly they needed housing for their employees who were there to repair the tracks and work on the engines and so forth. So they would bring in whole houses, housing structures on a railroad flat car that would be shaped like that railroad car. And they would unload those at the new location and boom, you had instant housing for your employees. But that's why they're called railroad housing, because that's where the shape came from, this long, narrow shape that was based on the shape of the railroad car. So at any rate, it's South Fairbanks, south of town. There were half dozen to 10 of these railroad company housing things. And when they closed up the railroad and stopped operating out of Fairbank, they came, they loaded those on a railroad boxcar, and they took them somewhere else.
The reason I'm familiar with those, and this is another story for another day, but a friend of mine that worked for the railroad was building a house near Kingman, Arizona, 45, 50 years ago. And he got a deal on some of those apartments up in Drake, Arizona, up out of Chino Valley. And I was between jobs. I got laid off from the mines. And so I went up there and camped and dismantled those houses and brought the lumber to Kingman, Arizona. That's how I was familiar with those kind of
So you're the one, huh?
Yes, I was one of the ones. That's about a place of Drake, Arizona. Another one of those little sideways.
The problem, I'm just kidding, of course, but I did hear a story. There's one of the families in Fairbank, the Darnell family. Their father, these are people that are in their 90s now, but their father was an employee of Southern Pacific Railroad in Fairbank, and he was the switch operator, the switchman, and it was his job to go out there, you know, these little mechanical flags that would go up and down that tell the trains which track they were going to go on. He would do that and switch the tracks. But one of his sons, named Robert, told me the story one time. There were four different train depots in Fairbank, and none of them have survived, which is a tragedy for me anyway. And so Robert told me, I said, whatever happened to all these train stations, Robert? Well, he said, you know, I used to own one of them. I came down here. There was one just north town. I jacked it up, put it on a truck, took it to my place up in Benson. It was on my land there. I said, oh, is it still there? Could I come see it? Well, you know, I had to sell that property, and the guy that bought it from me, he didn't want it there, so he burned it down.
Oh.
And this is what happens to history, you know. And I tell people this, you know, your question about what's left there, we get that a lot, you know, because they come into a ghost town. They're thinking of like Bodie, California or something.
Yes, where the whole town
is still there. That is not the normal ghost town.
No.
And so I tell them, much like I just did you, well, you know, this happened to this building, that happened, and so forth. And you know, that's just the way it goes. Piece by piece, the heritage is gone. You know, people in Arizona were poor. They weren't so much worried about preserving these old buildings from the past as they were with making a living in the modern day. So that was their emphasis.
Yeah. You know, it's surprising how many in the roughly 1890 to 1920 period, it's surprising how many small railroads were operating in the state, small railroad companies. Here near Kingman, up a little mining town of Chloride, Arizona, the depot is still there from the Arizona-Utah Railroad. And it's pretty amazing. I've got to get back down to Fairbank and that country. I haven't been down there in probably about 15 years, 10 to 15 years.
Well, here's what you need to do, Jim. And I'm going to the shameless plug about to come. So I'm actually now president of an organization called the Friends of the San Pedro River. We offer an extensive program of tours. We do nature tours. We also do what we call history walks, which are tours of a half dozen of the significant historic sites within the San Pedro Riparian National Conservation Area, which is the government property along the San Pedro River just east of Sierra Vista. I'm the docent for Fairbank. I do tours there. We also do tours of the Grand Central Mill and Millville, which were two of the Tombstone silver mills. We do tours of the Presidio Santa Cruz de Terranate, which was a Spanish fort on the San Pedro River. We do a tour of the Clanton Ranch site, which is where Ike and Old Man Clanton had one of their cattle rustling stops, figures prominently in the Wyatt Earp epic. And then finally, we do tours at Murray Springs. Now, we do these tours of the historic sites during the calm months or the cooler months. Our last one is coming up here in the first weekend in May. But at any point in time, if you go to our website and you can do a query on Friends of San Pedro River or our Facebook page, you can find schedules of these tours there. They basically run every Saturday during the fall, winter, and spring. Too darn hot to do them during the summer.
Yes.
But at any rate, so that's what you need to do. You know, synchronize your visit with one of my tours of Fairbank, and I will give you a personal tour.
Oh, well, you know what happens when you feed stray dogs? You never get rid of them. First of all, I want to thank you for your dedication to keeping this history alive and for taking time from your schedule this morning to share this. I will get a blog post done in the next day or so with the information and the links to the websites we've discussed today, and see if we can inspire a road trip or two. And I'll extend that invitation if you find yourself up here in northern Arizona. I'd be happy to give you the 50-cent tour. We've got some pretty fascinating historic sites and ghost towns in this area.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, I might just take you up on it.
We've got quite a bit up here. We've got the old Beale Wagon Road. There's some remnants from that. The Mojave Prescott Road went from the Colorado River ports in Fort Mojave to Fort Whipple and the Prescott territorial capital. Quite a few interesting ghost towns. I mentioned Chloride. Chloride still has a population, a couple hundred people maybe. Pretty interesting little town. Most of the ghost towns are less than Fairbank. They've been picked clean, and if they haven't been picked clean by salvagers, they've been picked clean by treasure hunters and things of that nature.
Yes. How far north did the riverboats go on the Colorado?
Quite a ways. They went up to El Dorado Canyon, just around the area of where Hoover Dam is today. Mm. There's a real interesting place just below Hoover Dam called Ringbolt Rapids. And there's a shelf cut in the canyon wall, and there's forged massive ring bolts in the canyon wall. What they had was a steam-powered winch that would pull steamboats through the rapids there at Ringbolt Rapids.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, they went quite a ways north up the river, but Hardeeville was one of the main ports on the river near present-day Bullhead City. The cemetery is still there outside of Bullhead City.
You know, somehow or other, local legends have grown up that have it that riverboats ran on the San Pedro River. It's amusing, but it was just impossible. I mean, even in pioneer times when it had marginally more water than it does today, there were always stretches of the river that were dry other than during the summer floods. A riverboat would have needed roller skates to get up the river. But yet it's accepted among many people in this area that, yeah, the riverboats ran here. And as near as I can figure, this comes from those Colorado riverboats that operated, and stopped operating pretty much as soon as the railroads arrived. And that was another point. Settlement in this area really didn't happen until the railroads arrived. So, you know, there was an interval in between or before the railroads during which the riverboats on the Colorado River could prosper. As soon as railroads arrived, that was over with. You know, there would have been no corresponding period here, but I really think people have seen photographs of the riverboats tied up there at Yuma. I'm sure you've seen those famous pictures. And they think, oh, yeah, that must be the San Pedro. But people are just convinced that riverboats ran up and down the San Pedro.
Well, we'll have to continue this conversation sometime on that subject, the legends, how things get overshadowed. And we talked about this Tombstone and Wyatt Earp. Things get blown out of proportion. You tell stuff long enough and then add enough movies to it, the myth becomes fact.
Right.
And I find history to be much more interesting. It's, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. Some of the stories from this frontier period, and something we can discuss too in a future program, I've been working to decipher my wife's family's history that's deep in that country. Her great-grandfather was born in the Tombstone area sometime around 1880, and he was the sheriff there in Cochise County at one point. And I have his 41 caliber Colt sitting here on my desk. And the Dos Cabezas, Wilcox, Pierce, her family was tied into that country at least until the early 1940s. They owned a hotel that burned in Tombstone, and then they relocated up here to the Kingman area. So that's another connection. Ron, I've enjoyed this immensely today, and I want to thank you for taking time from your schedule on a Sunday morning to do this. And I hope we've inspired some people to read up on Mr. Milton and Fairbank, and we'll make a little bit of a detour. It's a little bit of a Route 66 detour. A lot of our programming is focused on Route 66, but my pa always said the world was round. If you head east long enough, you're out west. So what's a little detour of a few hundred miles for a grand adventure? Next week, we're going to do some, side trips, we're going to be talking to Reese Martin, the president of the Oklahoma Route 66 Association. And he's got quite a story, personal story, I think you'll find interesting. But of course, we're going to be talking a lot about the Route 66 Centennial and breathing new life into some pretty fascinating rural Oklahoma communities that have a colorful and interesting history. And then after that, we're going to talk to Angela Moreland in McLean, Texas. And McLean is another town that has a great history that's often been overlooked. One of my favorite stories from McLean is the Barbed Wire Museum is in McLean, and it's in an old brassiere factory that gave McLean, Texas, the unofficial title as the Uplift Capital of Texas. That's going to be a great story. Ron, again, I thank you, and I thank everybody who joined us this morning. And Ron, if you don't mind, I'd sure like to do this again sometime.
Anytime.
My friends, do you have any questions before we button this up? We've got quite a crowd with us this morning. We've got Chris Tuttle with the Arizona Podcast Program with us. And we've got people from as far away as East Lansing, Michigan. And we've got a fella here that joins us on a regular basis from Scotland, it looks like, with us today. My friends, again, thank you very, very much. And I hope you enjoyed this. Drop me a note. I'll have the blog post up on the Jim Hinckley's America website probably this afternoon or tomorrow afternoon at the latest. And I'll have information where you can get a hold of Ron and find out about these tours. And I'll be publishing the podcast later today. It'll be on Spotify and other podcast platforms. And then, of course, we have an embedded player on the Jim Hinckley's America website. Ron, again, thank you. And until we do this again next week, I will bid everyone adios. And we'll send you on your way with a little bit of music from Joe and Woody and the boys of the road crew. Ron, take care, my friend.
Adios.
Say hello to a new friend on an old road. Take a two-lane trip of memories into mysteries unknown. Come along for the ride. Jim Hinckley's America. Jim Hinckley's America.
Until we do this again, my friends, next week, Vaya con Dios, mi amigos.